It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. A Tunisian terrorist attack kills at least 21 people, including 17 foreigners. Gunmen wearing military-style clothing and carrying assault rifles opened fire midday Wednesday at one of the Tunisian capital's biggest tourism sites, the Bardo Museum, an attack that left at least 21 dead, many of them foreigners, and more than 40 wounded. A small group of captives was taken, but was freed in a security operation that left two of the attackers dead. A policeman was also killed. The identity of the attackers and their motive remains unclear. Prime Minister Habib Hassid, speaking during a news conference, said Tunisians should not allow, quote, this horrific crime to affect the nation's morale or democracy. The attack also drew international condemnation, including from U.S. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki.
We extend our heartfelt sympathies to the victims' families and loved ones. We commend Tunisian authorities' rapid response to today's wanton violence and their efforts to resolve the hostage situation and restore calm. The United States stands with the Tunisian people at this difficult time and continues to support the Tunisian government's efforts to advance a secure, prosperous, and democratic Tunisia.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon also condemned Wednesday's attack. In Nigeria, soldiers from Niger and Chad announced the liberation of another town from the Islamist militant group Boko Haram. According to the Associated Press, soldiers retook Damasak near the Nigerian border, which the insurgents have held since November. Commanders say soldiers killed more than 200 of the militants. At the UN, Chad reportedly is circulating a draft resolution in the Security Council to endorse the multinational military action against Boko Haram. Meanwhile, the presidents of Ghana and Chad announced a regional summit scheduled next month on a common strategy to confront Boko Haram. This is VOA News. A day after securing re-election, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he would do everything in his power to ensure the well-being and security of all Israeli citizens. The Israeli leader said he was touched by the weight of responsibility the people of Israel placed on his shoulders after his conservative Likud party scored a resounding victory in the country's Tuesday election. Likud captured 30 of the Knesset's 120 seats. Polls had predicted a tighter race against the center-left Zionist Union Party, which eventually took 24 seats. Avraham Diskin is a political science associate professor at Hebrew University.
In the very last minute, I think that people had a sense of urgency on the right. Okay, the left is having too much power. The Zionists can be too successful. So that movement from satellite parties took place at the very last moment. And that's the reason for the result that we have.
Mr. Netanyahu says he intends to form a coalition government within weeks to give him a third consecutive term in office. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry called to congratulate him on the victory. A U.S. spokesperson said Washington will evaluate its policy toward a two-state Israel-Palestinian solution in the wake of Mr. Netanyahu's pre-election statement. He no longer supports it. A U.S. drone strike in southern Somalia killed Adan Garar, a top official of the Somali-based Islamist militant group al-Shabaab. U.S. defense officials confirmed the March 12 attack on Wednesday. The Pentagon says he had worked for al-Shabaab's intelligence wing and was connected to the 2013 attack on the Westgate Mall in Nairobi, an attack that killed more than 60 people. Sierra Leone's President Ernest Bai Koroma Wednesday fired his vice president, Samuel Sam Subana, who was recently expelled from the ruling party on allegations he was instigating violence and forming a new party. The vice president, who remains in hiding, has denied the charges and sought asylum in the U.S. Embassy in Freetown, saying he feared for his life. The U.S. Central Bank, after holding a key interest rate to a record low for the past 6 years, signaled on Wednesday that the job market will have to improve further and inflation will have to rise a bit more before it raises that rate. That sent U.S. stocks soaring in Wednesday trading, but it forced the dollar in sharp losses against the yen and euro. World Health Organization Chief Margaret Chan said Wednesday she'd like to drive tobacco companies out of business. Dr. Chan said cigarette companies use all kinds of tactics to try and undermine anti-tobacco laws, including funding political parties and giving money directly to politicians. The WHO says tobacco kills an estimated 6 million people a year. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Vati in Washington. Today is Thursday, March 19th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. A Tunisian museum standoff ends with about 19 people dead.
Terrorists pick targets because they know it will have certain impact. And so it's not just killing unknown tourists in a museum. They wanted to kill Tunisia.
Saeed Sadek is a Cairo-based professor of political sociology. Democratic Republic of Congo will expel foreign pro-democracy activists who is said try to destabilize the government. Guinea's opposition lawmakers boycott parliament and the elections commission. And Sierra Leone President Ernest Bai Koroma defends the decision to sack his vice president.
The president had to relieve him of his duty, citing specifically Section 41B, which disqualifies the vice president by virtue of the fact that he has been relieved of his status as a member of the political party under which he came into government as vice president.
Abdoulaye Birete is Sierra Leone's government spokesman. Zimbabwe opposition lawmakers go to court today to challenge their expulsion from parliament. And a UN envoy lobbies for safe schools in conflict and crisis areas. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Tunisia's prime minister says 19 people, including tourists, were killed on Wednesday when gunmen targeted visitors to the country's Bardo Museum. Among the dead are 17 tourists from Poland, Italy, Germany, and Spain. Two of the gunmen were also killed when security forces moved in to end the standoff. Prime Minister Habib Haissed said during a press conference that two members of the security forces were also killed during the operation. It remains unclear who the gunmen were. Tunisian officials are calling the assault an attack on tourism and the Tunisian economy. But as viewers Heather Murdoch reports from Cairo, some analysts say it also appeared to be in retaliation for the country's new counterterrorism measures.
On Tunisian television Wednesday evening, Prime Minister Habib Essed called the fight against terrorism a long-term battle for the future of the country and its success. He said the attack on Tunis's famed Bardo Museum was intended to hit the economy by harming the tourism industry, one of Tunisia's most important economic sectors. Cairo-based professor of political sociology Saeed Sadek says militants in Tunisia have in the past targeted security forces, making Wednesday's attack especially disturbing.
Terrorists pick targets because they know it will have certain impact. And so it's not just killing unknown tourists in a museum. They wanted to kill Tunisia. They wanted to kill the economy of Tunisia. So this is really the target.
While it's not clear who was responsible for the attack, Sadek says it's likely one of the many militant groups that have flourished since 2011, when the Arab Spring uprooted Tunisia's security apparatus and weapons poured out of neighboring Libya.
Groups of smugglers and terrorists took over the arms depots in Libya. They stole them and smuggled them into everywhere, you can imagine.
Other analysts say the attack was not only an assault on the Tunisian economy, but a response to the government's recent crackdown on Islamic State supporters. Jan Saint-Pierre, the CEO of the Berlin-based security firm Mossecon, says the museum, situated next to the parliament building, could have been targeted specifically to shut down the work of the legislature, which Wednesday was to pass even tougher anti-terrorism laws.
The Bardo being so close to the parliament, it provided a soft target that allowed terrorists to disrupt voting on that bill. They succeeded. They had to evacuate the parliament because of the attack on the Bardo.
The attack, he adds, could have a long-term impact beyond human suffering by potentially destabilizing the Tunisian government. The tourism season, adds Emily Glein, a journalist with HuffPost Tunisia in Tunis, is just about to start. So for the economy, the The timing couldn't be worse.
It's always surprising when something like that happens in your city in Tunisia. Even if we knew that there's always a risk of an attack, we were surprised.
But Saint-Pierre adds that while no one expected Wednesday's attack to come now, as the chaos in neighboring Libya deepens the regional security crisis, he expects terrorist attacks against soft targets like the museum to continue. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
Sierra Leone's Vice President Samia Sam-Sou Mana, who was dismissed yesterday Wednesday by President Ernest Bai Koroma, released a statement late Thursday saying his purported removal from office is unconstitutional and unlawful. Sam-Sou Mana said he was duly elected to the post and therefore President Koroma has absolutely no power to dismiss him. But government spokesman Abdoulaye Birete said the vice president was expelled on March 6 by the ruling All People's Congress APC party. Birete said Sierra Leone's 1991 constitution mandates that one must be a member of a political party in order to become president or vice president.
The APC party, which is the governing party, found the vice president former wanting after some members of his region he came from made a formal complaint to the party that the then vice president was involved in some anti-party activities. And later, he was found wanting, and the party evoked Article 8 of their 1995 constitution, and he was expelled. And when that factored into our own constitution, 1991, which, of course, made certain criteria before somebody can become a president and a vice president, one, you must be a member of a political party. But what broke the camel's back was when the vice president last Saturday sought political asylum from the U.S. embassy, claiming that his life was under threat, which in the view of the president was like abdicating your duties as a vice president. So that was why the president yesterday had to relieve him of his duties, citing specifically Section 41B, which disqualifies the vice president by virtue of the fact that he has been relieved of his status as a member of the political party under which he came into governance as vice president.
Abdoulaye, you are talking about dismissing the vice president of a country. Why are you citing APC constitution?
I am citing the APC constitution because of its direct bearing to the issue surrounding the vice president former, because it was the expulsion of him from the APC party itself that has a lot of legal implications by his continuing to be a vice president under the 1991 constitution, which according to Section 41B stated very clearly that one can only be a vice president or president if you belong to a political party.
Here's the question. People are saying that President Koroma used the vice president to get elected. And now, because he knows now he's not going to have a chance to run again, he's trying to get rid of the vice president so that he can get somebody else from his region.
That has never been the case here, and that has never been on the political debate. Because don't forget, in the first tenure of President Koroma, he nominated Alhaji Chief Samuel Sam-Sou Mana to be his running mate. But the fact that the president even chose Chief Samuel Sam-Sou Mana during the last 2012 election was a clear indication that, one, he worked with him very clearly during the first tenure and believed that Samuel Sam-Sou Mana will bring more added value to the presidency. But that notwithstanding, though, when somebody falters according to the APC constitution, it doesn't matter what is your status in government, which means even President Koroma, if he falters, a disciplinary committee will be set up. And once he is found wanting, based on the gravity of the situation, he will be slammed either a suspension or an expulsion.
Sierra Leone government spokesman Abdoulaye Birete was speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. Guinea's opposition lawmakers boycotted parliament yesterday, Wednesday, to protest the announced timetable for presidential elections, which the Electoral Commission said will take place in October this year. Ousmane Diallo is the member of the executive committee of the Opposition Union of Democratic Forces Party. He says the Electoral Commission's decision is illegal because the Constitution requires that municipal elections be held first before presidential elections. Diallo said the opposition will no longer recognize the Electoral Commission.
We need to boycott the parliament because our government and our president has not respect the disposition of our constitution for the election. Because for the presidential, our commission, national of independent for the election, has decided to organize first the presidential election. But our constitution is clear at this point. After local election, we need to organize the presidential. But we don't know why the president and government need to organize the first the presidential. That's it's illegal decision, and that's the reason why the opposition decided to boycott our parliament.
So the opposition is saying now that it will no longer recognize the election commission. Why?
Because the election commission has not worked. The commission working in illegal. We take the decision. Decision is not legal. This is the first point. The second point, the composition of commission election is illegal, and the decision is taken for the next election is illegal. We need to have 10 members from opposition and 10 members from government, 3 members from civil society, and 2 members from Minister of Administration Territorial. But right now we have 3 members. That's illegal. Secondly, is take the decision to organize first the presidential election. If you look our constitution, we need to have local election before.
Do you understand also the president saying that because of the Ebola crisis?
The Ebola crisis is not a reason to vote for the election because the country near to Guinea, Liberia, has organized a senatorial election in with Ebola. That's not the reason.
Why not just go to the presidential election, I mean, to see if you can win the presidency?
We can because, you know, the local election is decide where what member to control the organization, the election in local city.
Does the opposition want a new electoral commission and a new chairman?
We need a new electoral commission and the legal commission election. 10 members from opposition and 10 members from government. That's the first point. We need the local election because the local election is very, very important for the presidential election. We need that. Because if we haven't local election, we can control the next election. Actually, the government control everything for the presidential election. That's not democratic.
Ousmane Diallo is a member of the executive committee of the Opposition Union of Democratic Forces Party of Guinea. You are speaking with me from the capital, Conakry. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, March 19th. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 18 minutes past the hour. In Zimbabwe, the opposition MDC Renewal Team, a breakaway faction of Morgan Tsvangirai's Movement for Democratic Change, says it will file a challenge with the Constitutional Court today against the expulsion of its lawmakers from Parliament. House Speaker Jacob Mundenda granted a request by Mr. Tsvangirai's MDC yesterday to recall all 21 lawmakers who had broken ranks with the party. Renewal Team spokesman Jacob Mafumbe says they are confident of a victory.
We are challenging the decision by the speaker. There is no right to recall in our constitution. There is a right for floor crossing. Section 129 refers to floor crossing. No one has crossed the floor. We have had a dispute with our colleagues who have teamed up with ZANU-PF and promised Jonathan Moyo the Cholocho seat and among other seats, and they have put an underhand deal to donate these seats to ZANU-PF. We are going to challenge that in court because there was no reason for the speaker to change the rulings he has given before, which were in tandem with the law and the constitution. This decision by the speaker is bad at law and in fact. What is surprising is the willingness of our colleagues to work with ZANU-PF at this stage. We want to highlight to the people that this is a beginning and not the end.
Some say your odds are just too long in this case. What do you make of that?
Well, our odds are very good. We are of the view that this case is winnable. This case, in terms of the law, is as clear as a light at night.
Jacob Mafume is spokesman for opposition MDC renewal team of Zimbabwe. He was speaking with reporter Untungamile Nkomo of VOA Zimbabwe service. The government of the Democratic Republic of Congo says it has decided to expel foreign pro-democracy activists from Senegal and Burkina Faso who were arrested in Kinshasa for planning to destabilize the government. Information Minister Lambert Mende says the decision was reached following communication between President Joseph Kabila and the presidents of either Senegal or Burkina Faso. He also said a U.S. diplomat, Kevin Stahl, who was arrested in the area where the activists were training, was also released.
Those people are from activists for Senegal and Burkina Faso who tried to come here and train some of our young people to resist public authority, to oust the regime before even the term of elections. And we said that we could not accept this way of doing things. This is why the police arrested them. And after some exchange between our president and one of the two heads of state of their country, the president decided to order that we expel them from the country.
Is it true that a U.S. diplomat was also arrested?
Yes, they arrested the U.S. diplomat who was found in the place where they were training these young men to destabilize our country. And the diplomat was free only when officials from the embassy came. But still, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs must hold some contact with the embassy and the government of the United States about the behavior of these diplomats that is not fit with the what we know a diplomat should do when he's sent in a country.
Human Rights Watch has criticized your government, Mr. Minister, saying that the arrest of the pro-democracy activists is part of a crackdown by your government against protesters ahead of elections.
I think that it is a ritual for Human Rights Watch to criticize government like ours. They don't care about truth, about lies or what. They just care about speaking of Human Rights Watch, just. So we do not really care about Human Rights Watch because they are more people looking for publicity than human rights fighters.
You know, I think all this will be over if President Kabila comes out and says, look, I'm running for re-election or I'm not running for re-election. People will have no reason to protest.
This is stupidity because if someone did not say that he's running for election, for which reason are you fighting to bring him to say that he's running for election? Kabila is the only one to say if Kabila will run for election. He never said that. But we are hearing the people, Human Rights Watch, people from Senegal, Burkina Faso, they are more aware of the project of Kabila than Kabila himself. We are astonished.
Lambert Mende is Information Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. UN envoy, a special UN envoy for global education, Gordon Brown, is urging international support for a number of initiatives to get 28 million children back to school in conflict and crisis zones around the world. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir has more.
Education Envoy Brown said schools used to be safe havens for children, but are increasingly becoming instruments of war, with more than 10,000 attacks on schools across the globe in the last 5 years. Brown, a former British prime minister, urged the international community to invest in making schools safer, calling for the establishment of a multi-million dollar global humanitarian fund for education in emergencies.
It is our moral duty to make sure that every single child in the world can enjoy the basic right to education, free of terror, free of fear, and with the support of the international community.
New uses for technology is one way he's looking at improving school safety. Working with a U.S.-based technology firm, Predictify.me, a pilot program is being started in Pakistan, where 3 months ago the Taliban attacked a school in the northwest city of Peshawar, killing 140 children. Now, 1,000 schools in 4 provinces and Islamabad will benefit from new computer software to assess safety and recommend ways to improve it. Brown said it is a major step forward in a country where more than 5 million children do not go to school.
We have now a means by which we can hold the government and the schools accountable for whether they are fortifying the schools, whether they're making the schools safer, and whether, of course, they are monitoring the possibilities of terrorist attacks.
The special envoy also called for the release of more than 200 girls kidnapped by Boko Haram militants in the northern Nigerian town of Chibok nearly 1 year ago. He said more than 10 million children are out of school in Nigeria, the most anywhere in the world. His Safe Schools initiative has helped marshal $30 million for protecting Nigerian schools. One way it helps young people get back to learning is through transferring students who attend schools in the highest risk areas affected by Boko Haram to ones in safer regions. The Syrian conflict has shut 3 million children out of school, many for several years. A half million of them are refugees in neighboring Lebanon. Envoy Brown is working with the Lebanese government on a double shift plan. Lebanese children would attend public schools in the morning, and Syrian kids would attend the same schools in the afternoon. Brown said it is time the international community wakes up to the struggle going on for the rights of vulnerable children and stop turning its back on the victims of war. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Marco Uma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Nigeria beat Ghana 2-0 in semi-final action at the Africa Under-20 Championships in Dakar, Senegal on Wednesday. Today, Thursday, Senegal faced Mali in the other semi-final. In basketball, South Africa women overcame their limitations to recently qualify for the 2015 All-Africa Games and Africa Women's Basketball Championships, beating Zimbabwe and Botswana at the Africa Zone 6 contest in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe. Team manager Sibongile Maswanganye explains.
It was a good experience, and South Africa only played at the All-Africa Games in 1999 when we were hosting, and since then we haven't been playing into that competition because we haven't been qualifying. And also for the AfroBasket, the last time we played it was 2009 in Madagascar, and competition was very tough. It has been difficult, and it has been dry for women basketball in South Africa. We don't have a proper league that, you know, we are given a platform where we can develop the players. The only league that is there, it's school and at the tertiary levels. For us, you know, taking a team which has 7 rookies, it was a high risk. You know, nobody believed that we'll come back qualified. But nonetheless, you know, we promised ourselves that let's go out there and do our best and make sure that we come back with a ticket to both the All-Africa Games and the AfroBasket tournament.
Did you have any international matches to build up before you went to Zimbabwe? Remember, Zimbabwe were on their home turf.
And then we had about 3 training camps here at home. And one of the other camps that we had to travel to was to Mozambique. This was 2 weeks before we go to the qualifiers themselves. It was a good exposure for the young ones. Like, Mozambique's structure in basketball, I must say, is very tough. And when we were there, I mean, there was no day when we go to the courts and the basketball courts were just not being busy. I mean, from 9 o'clock in the morning until 10 o'clock at night, the courts are packed. I'm talking about from the age of 6 years old, 15 years old, you know, all age groups are there up until the seniors now team. But then the clubs that we played, they were very strong. So we came back, you know, very strong, and understanding that when we go to Zimbabwe, it's not going to be on the silver platter. Only one team needed to qualify. And the AfroBasket is a qualifier for the Olympics.
That was Sibongile Maswanganye, South Africa women's basketball team manager, speaking in Johannesburg, South Africa. Finally, South Africa outclassed Sri Lanka by 9 wickets in quarterfinals at the Cricket World Cup in Sydney, Australia on Wednesday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Tunisia's prime minister says 19 people, including tourists, were killed Wednesday when government targeted visitors to the country's Bardo Museum. Among the dead are 17 tourists from Poland, Italy, Germany, and Spain. That's it for this Thursday, March 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post-editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Jamie Cook, I am James Barton in Washington, wishing everybody a very good Thursday.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for VOA's discussion program, Reporters Roundtable, every Thursday at 1730 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas and take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. So please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA.
Sports fans, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. And on Fridays, you can also hear my 30-minute show at 17:30 UTC. On the internet, like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Check voaafrica.com for the addresses and enjoy the show.